I was attending UC Santa Cruz, we would do art shows at the end of each quarter. And being a double major in both art and physical anthropology, I wanted to, in my last show, combine the two majors.
This is Ryan Lely, a Sonoma-based artist and entrepreneur whose access to the Anatomy Lab afforded him some unusual art supplies.
I was working in the Anatomy Lab at the time, and so I thought, what better way to combine the two majors than to have an anatomical portion for my art show?
Now, when you say portion, we mean a portion of somebody's anatomy.
Yes, yes. These were people who had donated their bodies to science. And I went through all the necessary paperwork to harvest what I needed to make this happen.
But what was it that you thought you needed?
Well, oddly enough, it is something that I do need myself. Being an insulin-dependent diabetic, I needed a human pancreas and spleen.
We should back up here. What was your conception for this installation?
What I wanted to do was create a piece that really pulled on the visceral, like, ties of this disease that I have and kind of putting it in other people's faces, you know, which as a young installation artist was, you know, what people did.
You have to imagine a pedestal festooned with used syringes with caps, on top of which sat, encased in resin, a pancreas and a spleen. The title of the piece is Mine Doesn't Work, But His Did. When the show was over, did you feel responsible for the pancreas?
Yes, I felt very obligated to take it home because I harvested these. I took them from this person, so I should take them with me.
You brought the pancreas and spleen home,
mm-hmm.
and then you moved.
I did. It was the end of the quarter, so I moved out of the apartments on campus.
And you moved all your belongings except
the pancreas and spleen.
Now, why were you trying to lose them?
Because it was kind of gruesome, you know, having this pancreas. I mean, the pancreas is not a pretty organ. I mean, a spleen looks like a small kidney, you know, but pancreas, not so much. It's just gelatinous organ that's maybe this was about 6 inches long.
And so you literally packed up your stuff,
yeah.
moved away, and you left the pancreas and spleen.
I did, and I actually remember I left it in the closet. I did.
For the next tenant to find? I mean,
well, they have cleaning crews that go through during the summer and clean out the apartments and the dormitories. You know, it's a student job.
So I'm assuming you hoped that it would be found and discarded.
Yes.
And the onus would be off you to have
yes.
dealt. Okay.
Yes.
But what happened?
Well, oddly enough, the person that was cleaning my apartment knew of my art piece and recognized the pancreas and spleen. And held on to it. And held on to it for quite a while. Cut to a year, maybe 2 years later, run into this person. Oh, hey, I have your pancreas and spleen. And, you know, that's just a weird thing to have confront you on the street.
And yeah. you had to accept it. So what, did she send them back to you?
Like, no, we arranged a drop-off and she handed it over and I took it. But this wasn't the last time I tried to lose it.
Well, okay, so you attempted to...
I did attempt to do it again.
So you switch dorms, you leave the pancreas and spleen behind again.
Yeah.
And again...
It finds me.
How?
Same way.
Not the same person.
Not the same person, different person.
So the installation made such an impact that it was part of campus lore. To wit, if you misplaced your pancreas and spleen, intentionally or otherwise, they would find you and give it back to you.
Yes. And in that moment... I was like, okay, this is a little uncanny. And so I had just had to stop. And I was like, all right, Ryan, you took these two organs out of this person. You need to keep them. It was like this wake-up call. It's like you cannot be flippant about this. Like you need to keep these things.
And now you're the caretaker.
Yes.
Of a pair of organs.
Yes. That do not work in me, or at least one of them doesn't.
So this is one of those deals where you try to lose something, it found you.
Yes. It literally, after me finding it, it kept finding me.
So I guess in some ways the karmic balance is kind of set.
I've actually had a museum approach me and say, if you'd like to redo this piece, we would love to help you do this. And I've thought about it.
You mean reuse the organs?
I think at that point I would probably have to redo the entire piece.
You mean get new organs?
Yes. And I don't know. I mean, I'd have to go through the same channels again, obviously. But
Ryan, that's all well and good for the art, but you're going to have a closet full of pancreas.
I guess I'm making up for things I've lost.
Welcome to Arts ID. I'm Gretchen Giles.
I'm Daedalus Howell.
Arts ID is a monthly production of KRCB, the North Bay Bohemian, and the Arts Council of Sonoma County.
It's sort of a arts magazine, if you will.
An audio magazine that looks at North Bay arts from all genres, from all different points of view.
Every episode has a theme, and this one is lost and found. We'll find ourselves between the pages of books. We'll find pages themselves afloat. We'll find ourselves on the beach. We'll find ourselves here, there, and everywhere as we lose ourselves in Arts ID.
Obviously, we all lose things and find them all day long. I mean, it's you don't even think about all the things that you lose and find.
Well, there's something to be said about there's what's lost and then what's forgotten.
Oh.
Like perhaps in the leaves of a book.
Absolutely. David Templeton goes to a bookstore that buys used books where they find a lot of things lost in the leaves.
Mark Riltig.
What is it about books that make such perfect repositories for old memories? I don't know anyone who hasn't tucked something into a book and forgotten about it. A newspaper clipping, a funeral notice, an opera ticket, a photograph. There are all kinds of reasons we do this. Sometimes we just need a bookmark, and that old postcard from Yosemite just happens to be handy. Other times, we find ourselves holding something special, something that reminds us of a loved one or an important milestone from our children's lives, and rather than shove that memento in a box or under a pile of papers, we take a book down from the bookshelf, slip that memory between its pages, and slide the book back into place. Tucked inside books, our memories just feel safer. We never intend to leave them there, of course. We always believe we will come back someday and relocate that scrap of paper, that dog-eared photo, to a more appropriate place. Sometimes we do that. Many times we don't.
I read that. That's Archaeology of Garbage. Aerobic walking.
At Copperfield's Used and Rare Books in Petaluma, literally thousands of books are processed every week, between 2 and 5,000. According to manager Art Kusnets, who this morning is sorting his way through 50 cardboard boxes, each crammed with unwanted books.
Oh, that's cool. Art of the short stuff.
Most of the books that come through are a systems generalist's dream. We get a little bit of everything, and that's part of the excitement of working here, is you never know what's going to come in over the counter.
And once in a while, once in every 20 or 30 boxes of books, there's something else in the book, something slipped inside and forgotten about.
And if there's anything inside like this.
This one is only an old Amazon book receipt. This morning's load, from which Kusnets will purchase nearly 200 books, ends up yielding only two such receipts, an old newspaper clipping about gardens, and a few prayer cards, hidden away inside a very old Catholic prayer book.
I have to buy this. How often do you see a history of...
In the 15 years that this used and rare emporium has been operating down in the basement of Copperfield's bookstore, such discoveries have occurred hundreds of times, with Kusnets or the members of his staff discovering the unexpected treasures, from ancient family photographs to what Kusnets calls ephemera, with a giddy mix of delight and excitement.
Well, usually it's quite some time after we purchase the book that we'll find it. As the books will sit here and wait for an opportunity for them to be processed. So there is a little bit of excitement as you're going through the book and deciding what to price it. You might come across something. Some of the more interesting things that we've found, we can go out and take a look at now.
Near the front counter, atop a glass case of particularly rare and collectible books, sits a box filled with little lost bits of ephemera, each individually wrapped in clear cellophane bags. With every item priced between $1 and $5, the box is like a tiny history museum of misplaced memories. From old letters and postcards dating back to the turn of the century, decades-old computer punch cards, a booklet titled Hypnotizing Uncle Tavi, all the way to some true historical curiosities, a floppy disposable 33 and a third record titled Nixon's the One, a 1950s Department of Justice registration affidavit registering someone named Albert Schnacht as an alien enemy, and a pamphlet titled Observations Concerning the Nature of Gout.
This was something that we found in a book from, I guess, either the 20s or the 30s, which is a warning about wild youth. Educators in colleges and high schools of the country are almost unanimous in saying behavior conditions are better and less drinking among students since Prohibition, even though enrollments have increased by the millions. It's a pro-Prohibition statement. It's keeping our youth off the streets and in the schools. Here's another one that we found. War Ration Book Number 3. So this is probably from the early 40s. And then there are these sort of, what I call inadvertent funny. It's not really meant to be funny, but it's funny. Sing Song of Salads. Well, I don't know about you, but when I make a salad, I like to sing just as much as the next person. We've got the cream cheese cucumber ring, the deviled egg and tomato sandwich, the crab meat rolls, you know, the cinnamon pear salad, always a favorite. You know, hit the right note with your Miracle Whip salad dressing and Kraft mayonnaise. And then, of course, there's a woman holding a spoon, like a conductor would a baton, and the book she's reading from is A Gay Group of Recipes from the Kraft Kitchen. You can't make this stuff up.
To Kuznets, and apparently to the entire staff at the Petaluma store, such lost and forgotten items are viewed with the same sense of reverence and respect as the books that end up on the rows and rows of lovingly maintained shelves. This is especially true of photographs. Of all the things that routinely appear in incoming boxes of books, photographs are among the most common item. Photographs of weddings, of vacations, of birthday parties, photos of sleeping babies and dancing children and blissful couples at Disneyland, or victorious poker players in Vegas. How they end up in the books is anyone's guess, but to Kuznets and his staff, each and every lost photograph represents someone's life, someone's once precious memory. While some used bookstores might simply deposit lost photographs in the trash, the folks at the Petaluma Copperfields feel that to do so would be as disrespectful and wrong as destroying a rare book.
They're family. And, I mean, we're sort of the caretakers of books here. Bookstores are like halfway houses for books. They come here. They're the unwanted, the unwashed. We clean them up, make them look their best, put them in a nice new cover, and hope that somebody will come along and give them a home. So the same thing goes for those pictures. It's part of people's lives. It just doesn't seem right to throw them out.
From the beginning, whenever a photo has been found in an old book, the staff has saved it, protected it, for a long time merely keeping them safe in a file cabinet. Over the years, the gradually growing number of faces did begin to seem like family. So a little over 10 years ago, Daniel Waller, the store's assistant manager, brought in a big photo album.
Well, we titled it the Copperfields Extended Family Photo Album. You can see it's a pretty good-sized book. There's a lot of pictures in there. We tried to mostly stick to just portraits of people and not so much, you know, landscapes and whatnot.
The book is kept in the big back storage room, where the public is never made aware of its existence. The main purpose for the book, Waller says, is to care for the photos, to keep those memories alive in a small, poetic way, by saving them from the dumpster and the landfill.
We just felt it was like people's memories and whatnot, and couldn't quite bring ourselves to get rid of them. And instead of just leaving them in a box, we thought it would be kind of fun to put a book together. There's a few favorites in there. As you can see, it's mostly family pictures and get-togethers and baby pictures, and there's some, photo booth pictures, and Harrison Ford. We somehow got an autographed picture of Harrison Ford in here.
Over the years, the staff have identified their favorite photos that suggest fascinating backstories. For Waller, it's a photo of a couple standing hip-deep in a river, performing some sort of elaborate yoga exercise or water ballet. For Kuznets, it's a photo of a middle-aged man sitting on a very famous chair.
I suppose that's probably my favorite picture. If I I had a favorite. It's an unknown individual, obviously, has not lacking for any meals, sitting in his denim jacket and chinos in the command chair for the USS Enterprise. Of course, he's on set. And this is probably at the Star Trek Experience in Las Vegas. He doesn't appear very comfortable in the chair. It's the he might be suffering from hemorrhoids, or there might be some other problem. He's not quite comfortable. He's not quite sitting in the chair, enjoying himself, relaxing at command. He seems a little ill at ease, and he's got this little glow around him. I guess it's just the lighting.
The inherent sweetness of the book, the odd living poetry of these clerks and booksellers tending so lovingly to the mislaid and misplaced photos, the scraps of yellowing paper, the weird ephemera, does not seem obvious to Waller or to Kuznets, who simply see their caretaking as the obvious choice. Though these items have been discarded, Kuznets and company never forget that each piece of paper represents a living person, a life lived, and in some cases, lives long gone.
I mean, that's what some of these things I just really was hesitant for a long time to sell. Here's an 1890s Valentine, and it's one of those old-style fold-out cards. And it makes you think, well, who put it in the book? Why didn't they throw it out? It meant so much to them that they put it in their favorite book and kept it for 100 years for all these objects. If once they were lost, now, in some way, they're found.
You're listening to Arts ID, KRCB 91 FM.
I'm Gretchen Giles.
I'm Daedalus Howell. You know, it's interesting. Those guys are sort of like accidental curators, finding these things and then and collecting them, assembling them and saving them. And
I love how David Templeton's piece ends on that grace note, you know, with the bookseller quoting Amazing Grace, what once was lost, now is found.
Speaking of lost and found, they say it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all, right? But what if you found your love by finding things?
Next up, we're going to meet a West Marin couple. They're both artists, and they specialize in finding things that other people have lost, usually things people wouldn't even know that they might have lost, the small little items that slip out of your life. Hey, where's my lighter? You know, that kind of stuff. They find it, and they use it to make new things.
I'm kind of lost. Mark, can you roll the tape?
Judith Selby Lang's 60th birthday began with her ordinary routine. She and her husband, Richard Lang, went to the beach, and they picked up trash. But make no mistake, the Langs, who are artists, weren't merely trawling for any old garbage. They're looking for plastic. And man, do they find it. Since 1999, when they began religiously walking the half-mile stretch of Kehoe Beach in the Point Reyes National Seashore, the two estimate that they have gathered literally tons of the stuff. That's one barrette, one disposable lighter, and one Happy Meal toy at a time. Tons.
We know how the back feels after schlepping back from the beach. And the estimates, it's around 70 pounds every trip. So we don't want to overestimate, because hyperbole really gets you in trouble, and then nobody believes you. At the small end of the spectrum, it's at least 2 tons of plastic that we've picked up. And probably 4, maybe 5.
The Langs call what they do shopping or curating the beach, as the plastic doll parts, bits of oyster netting, and ubiquitous Bic lighters they find are taken home and sorted by color. Accordingly, the airy basement of their Forest Knoll studio is lined with cardboard boxes that are just simply labeled Big Black or Small Green.
When we're composing these pieces, the pieces of plastic are not what they once were. It doesn't matter what they were. They're there for color and shape, and very much like a piece of paint lifted from a palette and
right,
put on a canvas.
The pair collaborate on poetic assemblage of, say, 40 little girls' barrettes and photograph the resulting work. The Cavallo Point Resort in Sausalito recently commissioned a work for every guest room in its lodge. The whole thing literally began as a labor of love.
Well, I had gone to Richard's printing business to get an estimate for a project I was working on. And it just by chance, on the table there was a beautiful array of some photographs from Kehoe Beach. And Richard took a look at me and he said, "Hey, would you?" And I admired the photographs. And he said, "Well, do you like to go hiking? Do you like to go to the beach?" And so our very first date was at Kehoe Beach. It was there that we discovered that we each independently for several years prior to our meeting had been making artwork independently out of beach plastic detritus. We'd been collecting it and making it. So you cannot imagine our great thrill and delight to find another kindred soul. What are the chances of finding somebody who likes to do this as much as yourself? And so from that kind of happenstance of a meeting, a whole incredible life has unfolded for both of us. I'm kind of getting choked up just thinking about it.
Since then, the duo have collaborated on a number of projects. But it was the 2001 exhibition, titled One Beach, One Year, that they organized for the Gallery Route 1 in Point Reyes Station that really galvanized their commitment, well, to Kehoe Beach at least, and increasingly to the environment. To prepare for the show, the Langs went to Kehoe at least every week during what they call the high season. The rest of us know this as winter, when storms and winds load area beaches up with all kinds of dreck, muck, downed trees, dead animals, and more plastic than even the Langs can believe.
When we had the show, the One Beach, One Year show, Charles Moore, who was famous for his discovery of the North Pacific Gyre, he was just coming out with the public statement. This was in 2000 when we started this One Beach, One Year project. And when we had that show in at Gallery Route 1, people didn't believe us. That can't be true. And when it first came out, the public imagination was kind of ignited by this, oh, there's an island of plastic, it's an eighth continent of plastic, and that's really not true, and that's a bit of hyperbole that kind of diffuses things. What's really bad is that there is a lot of chunks of plastic out there, but it's hardly a continent. What happens is there's where they gain the evidence that it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So depending on where you sample in the water column, the plastic bits can outnumber plankton by 8 to 1 or 16 to 1 or 20 to 1. You can't see it from space.
Yeah, we describe it more like a minestrone. There are fragments and there are ghost net, big tangles and snarls of nets, but it's more like this stew of stuff all mixed up. And you really can't see it. So that's where the deniers say, oh, if you can't see it, it must not exist.
Right.
But they have scooped up samples. You can see on Charles Moore, on his Algalita website, where they've taken scoops, sample tubes of it, and you just see this sloshy kind of swirling mix of stuff.
So all of this brings us to one word, nurdles. Kind of a cute word. Totally not a cute problem. Nurdles are the building blocks of plastic items. They're chemically unstable. They're ready to be formed into water bottles, bike helmets, car dashboards, any of the hundreds of thousands of plastic items in modern rotation that surround us every single day. Nurdles are teeny. They're commonly spilled at the factory or in transit, eventually washing into storm drains and then out to sea. The Langs were recently on a pristine beach in Zanzibar on the Indian Ocean where there was no plastic at all until they picked up a big handful of sand and it was filled with nurdles.
They are a tiny, about a BB size piece of plastic, translucent or become somewhat discolored depending on how long they've been at sea. We, by accident, sort of discovered them ourselves. Richard had an injury and wasn't able to bend over and pick up. It can be quite vigorous. And so he decided he would demarcate an area in the sand about 4 feet by 4 feet, and he would just see what it would mean to clean the beach. And so he just started sifting through and discovered these tiny pellet-like pieces of plastic. And so when we returned home, we did, of course, what everyone does when you don't know something, you do an internet search. And we discovered, lo and behold, there it's a whole area of concern that we didn't know anything about. They're little round things, but they can be shaped into anything. They're heated and then molded into any kind of the car dashboard, anything made out of plastic. The source are these little pellets, and color can be added to them, and they're very lightweight, so they can be easily shipped. Here's some, these with these darker colors, that one's been at sea for a really long time. It's absorbed a lot of stuff.
They're very bouncy. They're not. You don't pay much attention to them. We had a friend who lived next to a plastic factory in Emeryville, and giant train tank cars would come filled with these things in great suction tubes, and then they would finish unloading, and the stuff would just fly all over. It was like snowdrifts. Mm-hmm. And there are places in England where the beach looks like it's covered in snow, and it's really... these nurdles. By their number, they're the most ubiquitous piece of plastic in the ocean. So this is how they know there are terrible things in the ocean, because the raw nurdles are chemically open, and so they absorb all kinds of things. Hopanes, which you're going to start finding in the Gulf of Mexico now, hopanes are what happens to an oil spill. It becomes this invisible chemical that's absorbed by anything that's plastic. And so you find hopanes, you find DDTs, you find dioxin, PCBs. The level of DDT in the San Francisco collection, or the Point Reyes collection, was very high.
But we don't use DDT anymore, right?
We don't use DDT anymore, but it's used in Mexico, all through South America, and it comes up the coast, and it's in these little things. And then, of course, fish eat them,
right.
And then we eat the fish, and this is how... Every person, not only does every drop of ocean have this stuff in it, every person has this right. stuff in it, at least all the people that have been tested.
In a lovely bit of urban poetry, nurdles are also known as mermaid's tears.
I don't know.
Is it maybe one of those urban legends, mm-hmm. but it really fits. It creates a provocative image because you can just imagine the ocean sort of crying out these little specks of terribleness. And once you see them, now we see them all the time. Now we didn't. They can look like a little bit of sand or a small rock, but once you discern them, it's forever.
We do little tests. So we did. Let's see how many we can find in 5 minutes, and so we each found 200. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I found 185. Judith found 210 because she's much better and quicker.
<it's> here we go. Back to marriage. The Langs cheerfully admit to who can do it best spirit to their collaboration. Together, the three of us are looking at a photographic print of some 12 disposable lighters, which are gorgeously underlit and remarkable for their varying patinas. They're marks of long ocean travel, the oil slick smears on them, and indeed, even the plant growth.
When we got started collecting, you know, is how many lighters can we find? And so for our One Beach, One Year in 2000, 2001, we wanted to see how many lighters we can find. And we thought, oh, our goal is 100. We can retire when we found 100. Well, after we found 200, we thought, well, let's start a foundation. We're so rich, because there's that feeling of this kind of strange abundance when you find the thing you're looking for. Anybody who's looking for something, when you find it, there's this sort of visceral thrill of, oh, wow.
Right.
This is great. So we got very competitive on the lighters. By the end of the year, we found over 600.
One of our aesthetic strategies is accumulating a group of things. So, for example, this image of the lighters. Just the simple array of them, you begin to really look at the variety of color, the shape, the sizes, how long they've been at sea. And we find that incredibly intriguing and very beautiful, mm-hmm. as do viewers mm-hmm. of our work.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it's a way around of the desperation that we feel because there is so much plastic that we never could really clean it up. So by creating for ourselves these games, we make fun of it, we make light of it, and it keeps us buoyant because otherwise we could definitely fall into a pit of despair.
It's no surprise that because their art materials consist almost solely of found plastic, that the Langs have become
well, basically, pollution experts. And, you know, the couple say that the increasing public awareness of plastic pollution and the state of the oceans actually gives them hope. Strangely, their pursuit of plastic brought the Langs themselves into the public domain. In 2001, when Judith was out on Kehoe taking a walk by herself, came across something really curious in the sand. She got a little closer to it, picked it up. It was red, after all. She had found a ballot box lid on Kehoe Beach.
Probably our most notorious find was a ballot box lid from the San Francisco election. 2001. I ended up on the front page of the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, and it led to a big investigation of the elections commissioner during that time. And the discovery of the ballot box lid actually ended up just being kind of a tip of the iceberg for lots of things that were going wrong at that particular time. But the key here, and I'm going to give a shout out for the artist intervention here in this situation, when I brought it home, Richard said, "Oh my goodness, do you know what you've found here? We need to make something important out of this." And he did. He took it down to Electric Works, to the shop, the print studio. And we made a large print poster that said, "Cast your vote away." And we put the ballot box lid, which is a bright red plastic thing with the seal of the city and county of San Francisco emblazoned on the front, and it made quite a strong, visible statement. And I think that was the thing that really captured people's imaginations, mm-hmm. adding the words and creating this, you know, putting this image together.
17 ballot box lids were found
over a period of time
and on Point Reyes and in the Bay. And it was a hotly contested election because it was the election to return Hetch Hetchy to the control of San Francisco. And it lost by 455 votes.
Accidentally helping to shape San Francisco politics is pretty cool. But mostly the Langs just keep doing what they do because they would never want to not do it.
Probably as you distill down, you know, what's the kind of kernel of our story is that we're just two little people on one little beach, half mile, and just what has transpired over time. So those are really the elements.
The really crucial element of the story is what happens when you focus your attention on one thing and just keep doing it. We had no idea this would turn into artwork. We had no idea we would actually make part of our living doing this. It's a fantastic story of what happens when you do the same thing again and again.
And that you go to the same place over and over again. We never tire of going to the beach. I'm so excited to go there today because when you really come to know a special place like we have the Point Reyes National Seashore. We're so blessed to have it right here in our backyard, but that we can return to it in any season. And we see the subtle changes of the landscape, the way the stream flows in to Kehoe Beach there. Sometimes it's full, sometimes it's empty, sometimes the beach is wide, sometimes it's narrow. And these subtle differences bring us great pleasure. We really enjoy the fresh air, going to the beach, and we would love to be put out of business. We couldn't think of anything finer than to go to the beach and have it be clean.
You know, what's interesting about your story, Gretchen, it's ultimately a love story between the artist and their relationship with the land.
Absolutely. I mean, through this odd shared hobby, they not only found a relationship that sustains them, but they found a real passion and a way to go into their art and to enlarge it as well.
But I also must say, where do we get words like nurdle? I mean, is there an etymological root to nur? Is there?
The Greeks certainly didn't think it up, did they? I mean,
no.
There's no precedent.
Nurdleless,
for it.
I think is.
I did have a girlfriend listen to me talk about this previously, and she misheard the word. She thought I had said nurbol with a B and not nurdle with a D, and she looked it up. So to nurble, because it is in fact a verb, is to pleasure oneself while wearing a suit of armor. Yeah?
Well, I'm going to get this chain mail off and do a little shout out to Arts ID on KRCB 91 FM.
So, Daedalus, you haven't always rambled through the bucolic hills of Sonoma County. You lived in Los Angeles for a while, didn't you?
I did time in L.A., as most media moguls have to.
Of course, you're still a screenwriter, but down there, you were, well, perhaps a less happy screenwriter than you are now.
I was a mopey screenwriter.
Yeah.
Between gigs and sauntering between Venice and Santa Monica, shuffling my feet, and lo and behold, I would often find, on the sidewalk or against the cyclone fence, pages of other people's screenplays. Pages that were lost, pages that I found, and pages that I'd like to share with you.
What we've done is we've asked North Bay actors to read these random pages. Now, each of these pages is literally one page of a script. Just take a listen to this groovy bit of randomness. It's five acts, five different scripts, five sets of actors.
Five lost and found pages.
Dad's underwear was in the side of a small antique dressing table, and only the briefs were kept there. Boring. Dad's sock drawer held the real treasures. This was a shallow drawer at the top of my parents' dresser.
Besides underwear, here my father kept
socks, handkerchiefs, a shoe spoon,
a few military watches he picked up cheap overseas,
a pocket knife, and a pocket watch that once belonged to his father, and a small gray box.
A brown clay box.
Full of antique coins.
Containing spare change from various countries.
A prescription pill bottle full of ashes from Mount St. Helens.
His class ring,
which he never gave to a girl.
And his mermaid statue. Dad liked to wear bikini briefs. Bill Blass, low-rise, mostly navy or dark green or black.
Just like the ones I saw on the boxes at
Shopko.
Or Kmart.
Or Kohl's department store. I would stand and stare in awe at the virtual mosaic of men in their undies.
Sexy undies.
While my fourth grade began to stir inside my white,
confining,
cotton, not sexy at all underwear that Mom bought me.
Yep. Hanging out with the guys on the man's underwear aisle was the best thing about a trip to Walmart. My favorites were the ones on the Brute and Jockey boxes. Now, Ian and I didn't like the Hang 10 boxes so much because there was always a woman standing behind the guy with her hand on his hip.
Yeah, f*** those.
Yeah, anyway, these men were really handsome and muscular. I didn't want to wear boring old tighty-whities like Dad. I wanted to look like these guys.
I was trying to be one of the group, and I figured if I could just get us to the concert, I'd be in, and Devin would finally have to shut his stupid pie hole. Anyway, I had no idea the whole thing would blow up like this.
Is there a point to this endless story?
Yes, sir. The whole thing was my idea. And it's not fair everyone should suffer. They were just victims of my charm and charisma.
You're accepting full responsibility.
And I'm starting to realize how good I have it.
Well, it's about time. Do you have any idea how many people are invited to this institution? Not many, but I chose you because every so often I come across someone with a gift who doesn't realize the value of what they have.
Exterior, motel. Jane lays by the bed while the white sheets spread over her. Jane slowly wakes up and finds herself alone in the bed. Instead, she finds a picture of herself flying a kite. Exterior, beach, morning. Diego stands peacefully on the sand looking out to the beach while the water hits his feet.
I haven't heard from Jane for 2 weeks after that, but she did call me. We might get together and do something. For her, that might have been a getaway from her boyfriend, but for me, it was my highway to Jane.
In his hands, he has the rest of the marijuana in the sandwich bag and sees a joint. He takes a last look at it and dumps it into the ocean as it washes away. Exterior, motel, moments later. Everyone loads their stuff and enters the van. Jane sits next to Diego in the back without saying a word. The car starts to exit the parking lot. Jane secretly reaches for Diego's hand. They both look at one another, feeling happy. Jane leans her head on his shoulder as she gets comfortable. George sees them close together in the rear window. Mary and George look at each other and smile. They drive off Highway 1. Freeze frame of the van on Highway 1. The end. Suddenly, he exits. She holds a moment, listening to his steps retreat, and steps into the bath. Ignatz finishes dressing in a clean jalaba. She goes to the window, stares out at the coming dusk. The sound of the muezzin can be heard in the distance, calling the faithful prayer. Ignatz kneels slowly and prays. Suddenly, she looks up. She rises, and stepping through the window, she goes out onto the balcony which lies beyond her room. Ignatz scrambles to the edge of the roof, looks for purchase to lower herself down. She finds a handhold. Ignatz's feet flail, search for support. Her leg scrapes against the plaster of the building.
It's peaceful.
Ignatz's legs go still. We hear steps on the balcony. Vial stands above Ignatz, looking west toward the desert through the binoculars.
It will not remain so. The English are out there, thinking of vengeance. Are you?
Ignatz's left hand slips from its handhold. She fights desperately to keep from falling.
Your duties will not be much. You will be well treated. You understand my meaning? You've been the wife of a sheikh, one in contact with Germans. Perhaps you have been a courtesan. These guests of your husband.
Ignatz loses her left hand grip altogether and swings from her right, dangling.
Five energy rays catch the Ilya in a hellish crossfire. The shields hold on for a second, then the matter-antimatter engine lets go. The Ilya explodes brilliantly. And for a few seconds, the Emperor's hanging gardens have two stars. The exterior shell of the sphere is no more. The hexagons, which once made up the sphere, are being thrown outward. Great bolts of red energy arc from the corners of the hexagons and cross the gaps between the gardens. The red energy seems to be pushing the pieces further apart. Huge bands of red energy arc across the heavens, overwhelming the light of the star.
This is what you had in mind, right?
Electra has a tight grip on Ned.
Well, not really.
I thought you as an archaeologist would be sure of your assessment.
Who said I was an archaeologist?
The world rocks beneath their feet. The hexagons are being thrown further apart by the red energy arcing in thousands of places around the sphere. A single arc changes from red to a highly intense blue beam from one hexagon corner to the next. It is focused and becomes rod-like. A second beam at the other end of the hexagon crosses the gap. The two ends, now aligned, bring the garden edge together. They meet with a perfectly lined joint. The same operation starts replicating itself from that point around the sphere.
You're listening to Arts ID, KRCB 91 FM.
I'm Gretchen Giles.
I'm Daedalus Howell.
Let's talk about what we just heard and how, what, where, when. What do you know about them?
What we heard was an Oscar speech waiting to happen. I think those guys did a great job. Some of this stuff wasn't as bad on the ear as it was on the page. I was surprised. Dad's Underwear actually might be a feat of good writing.
That was performed by Dodds Delzell and Eric Burke. Now tell us about sci-fi, or as I like to call it, galactic hexagons.
That opens on the exterior shot of the destroyer Ilya, which I thought was interesting. But we know that it's the end of the movie because it's page 114.
Well, how do we know that?
Well, a standard screenplay is about 120 pages, about a page a minute. So we're about 2 hours into the movie, and this must be the end.
This is when everything's blowing up.
Yeah, but it looks like they found love somehow.
Yeah, yeah. Somehow. Well, that was brought to us by the members of Narrowway Stage Company, and Charles Finucci did the sound. Rachel Custer, Nick Christensen, and Nora Summers were our actors for that particular segment. Okay, Ignatz, which I loved.
Yeah, Ignatz actually may have been a real screenplay at some point. It had a little polish to it, even though I didn't quite like it as much as some of the other ones. It's actually properly formatted.
And by that, you mean how it looks on the page. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's laid out like a professional screenplay.
Ignatz was performed by David Yen and Denise Alia. Jane and Diego was performed by Amber Templeton and Donovan Dutrow. Jason and Sherlock was acted by Donovan Dutrow and Dan Mackin. To see these script pages, which are covered in oil and coffee and blood and sweat and Lord knows tears, go to artsid.org. I'm Gretchen Giles.
I'm Daedalus Howell. Cut. You ever want to go back in time? I mean, to revisit memories, things you've left behind, parts of yourself you might have forgotten or lost? Well, Mickey McGowan has a way of doing that. It's not quite a time machine. It's, well, help me here, Gretchen.
It's a time capsule. Next, Amos Klausner takes us on a tour of Mickey McGowan's strange and marvelous world, the Unknown Museum.
Stepping into the Unknown Museum is hard to describe. One thing I can say is that it's a baptism, an immediate immersion into the world of Mickey McGowan. The Unknown Museum is one man's vast collection of American mid-century ephemera. Entering the Unknown Museum is like walking into a history museum, an artistic experiment, a house of worship, and a one-man show all rolled into one. And I was happy to have Mickey as my spiritual tour guide. I first heard about Mickey and the Unknown Museum a little over 10 years ago. I was doing some research on the Bay Area's folksy, handmade, trippy, native funk and flash design scene of the late 60s and early 70s. I kept hearing about a shoemaker and an artist who happened to have a giant collection of stuff. What kind of stuff? All kinds of stuff. Back in the early 70s, when he started collecting, Mickey was making shoes under the alias Apple Cobbler, and he was an early pioneer in the glue art scene. I knew the museum wasn't open to the public anymore, but I'd always wanted to visit. Only thing was, up until a few weeks ago, I had no idea where it was. So I phoned Mickey at the warehouse where he keeps part of his collection. We agreed to meet a few days later at the most recent incarnation of the Unknown Museum, his house in downtown San Rafael. He gave me the address, and I hung up the phone excited that the unknown would soon be revealed. I walked up the front steps and onto a porch stacked high with old televisions, rang the bell. Mickey opened the door and asked me inside. Over his shoulder, two life-size statues of Colonel Sanders stood guard, their smiles as inviting as a hot bucket of fried chicken.
I'd like to have occasionally somebody to talk to.
It's nice to have you over to discuss whatever.
We start the tour upstairs. Mickey brings me into a room that he set up for what he calls the American Girl. It's more art installation than bedroom, and it's overflowing with dolls, dollhouses, books, photos, and all sorts of other girly things that fill every nook and corner. A giant pile of stuffed animals takes up half the room. A few dozen Raggedy Ann's watch over everything from their perch on a shelf. I'm assaulted by the sheer volume of things.
Let's go over here to the book area, some of the books here. You can see them. Look at them all. Beauty Plus. You know, you had Going on 16, All About You. Bust Culture. Doctor Discusses Pregnancy. How to Write Letters for All Occasions. How to Have a Lovely Wedding, Information for Expectant Mothers, just on and on and on. And
I see you've got a lot of dolls, but I don't see many Barbies.
We have a lot of Barbies. A girl's room trying to document 20th century American culture would be very lax not to have a good selection of Barbies, at least in the Barbie culture, because she is the survivor of all survivors in the doll world.
I'm impressed and even a little overwhelmed with the museum, and I haven't seen much more than this one room. I have to ask Mickey, how did it all get started?
I came up to Marin 69, the Sausalito Art Center, great school that was in existence there, and had classes and private studios, which I acquired one, and was drawing and began making footwear. It was the Apple Cobbler, which was a shoe name, and I spurred myself in the 70s doing that. Every night there was something going on at the Art Center. It was just amazing. And I saw a little ad in the paper that said, building downtown Mill Valley for rent $200, and we set up a little museum, and it opened in Pearl Harbor Day in 1974, and I was, you know, I was living there and as a resident curator, changing the windows and things, and it just grew, and we became sort of a little matrix of hopefully some of the creative energy around Mill Valley at that time, which was quite a different town then.
After his first museum space, Mickey and the Unknown Museum bummed around Mill Valley, mostly retail spaces, and eventually to a house. All the while steadily collecting more and more objects up until, well, the collecting hasn't stopped. I wonder how he's collected so much material. Outside of the yard sales, swap meets, and the occasional rummage through the trash, I was surprised to hear about the coroner's office.
Usually these were homes that someone in the family truly didn't care about the things, so they would have the coroner contract out to have people come in and take care of the objects, which was where we came in. But they didn't really want the books or the thing, many of the things you see here, which aren't necessarily valuable, you know, like there's some, you know, everything's become so, what's the word, collectible, right, you know, but, you know, on the other hand, it was never our goal here. Although, I acquired a lot of this during the age of innocence, I like to call it, you know, sort of the 70s, before the internet, before eBay and the price guides were all prevalent.
Sitting in a small closet in the girls' room, with Mickey reading a teenage girl's pamphlet about bust culture, I was already getting a sense that, for Mickey, these objects were pretty powerful.
I have found, after, you know, experimenting with so many medias, video, all the way up to through videotape, sculpture, painting, that working with the common object was just so overpowering for me to make my statements as a visual artist through displays or dioramas or tableaus that I just couldn't match that with painting. With my limited talents, I could not match that, what I could do with perhaps having this chaotic effect of the objects.
Mickey's collecting reminds me of process artwork, where the act is more important than the result. And even though he says he's not trying to define the audience's reaction, he wants you to have an emotional experience.
If someone loses a doll, they still carry the memories. So it takes perhaps a visual to activate those memories. They can come here and refine them, reconnect with the memory that they have, and they uniquely have with that particular object, whether it be a doll or, in this room, a toy electric iron, some jacks, or a book on Cinderella, you know, a beauty queen pageant pamphlet, whatever it might be. I mean, your memory cells are always going to be there. They just need to be activated. I call it mind aerobics. You know, you sort of activate break up the fatty tissue around the memory cells, and you want to get... It takes an object sometimes to do that. You know, the past still has a lot of hidden secrets that we need to excavate.
We move on to the American Boys' Room. Like the last room, it's chock full of a colorful palette of globes and rockets, dinosaurs and marbles, microscopes and airplanes, and even some mannequins topped with an Indian headdress or a football helmet. Along the walls, Mickey's stacked and filled old aquariums with more toys and figurines. It's a nod to a young boy's mid-century fascination with sports and science.
As you can see, I feel like an astronaut in here. It's like, you know, it's like I'm surrounded in a womb of American culture, and we've got a gas station with a pile high with cars from the 50s and 60s. Here's Fort Apache stockade. Here's a spaceport with and here's a drawer full of boys' toy weapons, like little guns and wooden knives. There's fishing reels there's all kinds of stuff in here.
The way Mickey handles and talks about these objects, I know that there's a personal connection, even a deep sentimentality to what he's collected. You can tell Mickey really cares about these things, and they take him back a bunch of years to his own childhood. Back downstairs in his living room, surrounded by televisions playing old TV shows, Santa Claus statues, and stacks of metal lunchboxes, I wonder what he thinks about lost and found.
I mean, people lose interest in things, and other people find them, and it's a very basic rule of life. I mean, you have things for a while, and they drift from your conscious into your subconscious, and you sometimes they just go away, or you donate them, you throw them away, and somebody else picks them up, and they start playing with them. Or sometimes an artist will find them and start making a little artwork. And someday you might not even know. You might go to an art gallery and see something you threw away in an artwork and not know you threw it away. And therein lies the poetry, I suppose. It's beautiful, you know, the whole process of that. Very pure.
But to me, that sounds a little hollow. Okay, maybe not hollow, but I got the sense that this story is bigger than the objects themselves. And a funny thing happened when I pressed Mickey on why he collects so many items related to John F. Kennedy, like the newspaper sitting on his front porch from the day Kennedy was shot.
I have good memories of Kennedy. I don't just think of Kennedy and I don't really think of the assassination that much. Obviously, for my art, you might question that, but I think of the optimism that he brought to America after, I don't know, I didn't really think that Eisenhower era was bland. Well, it was happening. I guess it was. But Kennedy seemed to spark everybody.
Mickey says he doesn't think too much about the assassination, but I wanted to know what he thinks when he does consider it.
He lost so much. He lost the innocence. The violence was the age of so much changed. I mean, it's hard to put a finger on how important that event was. I was a little bit too young to completely realize it. I was in typing class in school when I heard it. It was on a Friday, so you had the weekend to absorb it. Maybe that's a big part of it. You had 2 days of no school as a kid to absorb it, then stay on Monday because the funeral's on.
Innocence and optimism. It's a theme that keeps repeating itself. Upstairs, standing in the boys' room, surrounded by model rockets and astronauts, I can picture Mickey as a young boy, staring into the stars and dreaming about a great tomorrow just over the horizon.
Yes, when I was growing up, there was the optimism of what was going to happen in outer space. We're going to, you know, like go out there and it was going to be, we're going to be there in 3 minutes and to another solar system, and we're going to mine and settle it, and we're going to have beautiful lands and all the, you know, of course there were the monsters and things too, but I always liked the, and then in the 60s we actually started shooting rockets up and we got into space, we got into our atmosphere, and that was wonderful and kept getting better and better, and we got on the moon in 69, and it was, then we hit a brick wall, it seems. And of course it all went up in smoke in
1986, the Challenger shuttle explosion, the day when American optimism went up in smoke. It was starting to make sense. Mickey was talking about, yeah, space monsters, but also about the loss of some truly American icons. Kennedy, the space shuttle, Leave It to Beaver, and geez, Wally, you could even weave this thread to include Mr. Potato Head. No, not the cranky one played by Don Rickles in Toy Story, the original one from 1952 that used an actual potato.
This is just a personal playland. I mean, I'm a cop to what it is, but there's dog tags. I love, you know, we've gotten those from the homes. I mean, there's so much. Think of the energy in those. I mean, don't you feel it when you hold them? You can feel power of those military tags, some right from Vietnam. And I'm after the power of objects, and that attests to it right there. If you just hold those, or even think about it, it could if you gave it time, really. It could liberate you, it could depress you, it could do any number of things.
It can get serious at times, but that's expected at Mickey McGowan's Unknown Museum. It's a life's work, an ongoing performance piece that keeps mining for value in the ideas and the emotions and the powerful associations held by simple objects that have come and gone and return again with each visit to the museum.
Memories, I think, are neutral. They have to remain neutral. They can be shoved under the carpet, or they can be exploited on a pedestal. I do both. There's a panic button here. Sometimes therapeutically I just come over and I'm having a bad day and I go, just push that button.
You're listening to Arts ID on KRCB 91 FM. I'm Daedalus Howell.
I'm Gretchen Giles. This month, Arts ID is brought to you by the words ephemera and detritus. Well, that was a great piece by Amos Klausner. And one of the things I really enjoyed about it is that Amos is a professionally trained fine art curator. So for someone with his background and expertise to sort of sift through the jumbled muck of the mid-20th century American mind with Mickey McGowan, it was a fun experience to listen
to.
It's
like one big mnemonic device. Every object in there triggers another memory.
Yeah.
I would go insane.
This month's theme has been Lost and Found. We've had a great time. And if you have lost any of tonight's program, we're going to direct you online, aren't we, Daedalus?
To artsid.org.
That's where you're going to find a lot of pictures of Judith Selby Lang and Richard Lang and their work.
You'll see Ryan's pancreas.
And you'll see Mickey McGowan's Unknown Museum.
And tons of Lost and Found screenplay pages.
I'm Gretchen Giles.
I'm Daedalus Howell.
Find us online all the time at artsid.org.
And find us on the dial next month on KRCB 91 FM.
Last Wednesday of the month, 7 p.m., Arts ID.
I'm trying to have the last word.